Well, first of all, I'm glad to be here. Thanks to the organizers for inviting me. I want to talk both a bit about one and two particle microreology. So basically an introduction to microreology, and I guess there will be more along those lines from Dave Waits or Margaret and Megan in the next days. I'll start with some single particle microreology work that Bernhard Schnurr was involved in. So this goes back to Michigan. And the collaborators in various stages of the work are listed down here. So Fred McIntosh was involved, Fred Gittes, Peter Olmsted, Bernhard, and all those guys are scattered, so I don't have enough space to list all the places. No, not really. Jay Tang and Karim Adas are collaborating, or I'm collaborating with them on the FD virus experiments, and Alex Levine was involved in that work. And if I have time at the end, I want to show some data on an inorganic system, colloidal rods. And that's a collaboration with Gijsje Koendering and Albert Philips's, and actually also Henk Lekkerkerker's group at the University of Utrecht. So let me start to motivate you. And Fred, of course, has done already part of that job. Why are we interested in these semi-flexible polymers, and do we want to measure their properties, and why do we want to measure them in a different way from conventional macroscopic rheology, namely in microscopic systems? Well, the motivation, of course, is partially biological. I hope the video at least works. This is a fish keratocyte that moves on the surface. So this is one of the prime examples or prime systems studied to understand cell motility. The scale is about 50 microns or so. The cell can actively move on a surface, and cell motility is important for many types of cells, for white blood cells when they want to fight infections, for wound healing when a tissue has to close up, and for many more purposes. Of course, cell division also is partially a process that is motile. This motility is brought about by a pretty complex machinery made of polymeric sort of structural elements, plus motor elements, active force-generating machines, plus a huge amount of regulatory proteins, mainly proteins, but also ionic regulation systems and so on, that control this whole machinery. And in a way, of course, the holy grail of working with these biopolymers is to understand such complex processes as this one, the cell motility. If you take a closer look, this, by the way, was stolen, I think, from Gary Brussi's website. So we don't have any keratocytes in our lab. This is an electron microscopy view of an actually a gut epithelial cell, and you see this network of actin filaments that Fred already talked about yesterday. You see bundles that actually extend outside of the cell and form these so-called microvilli that sort of enhance the surface area of the cell and give it a protective coating. But you see inside a pretty dense polymer network of polymers that seem more or less straight. Most of those are actually actin filaments. And this, of course, fulfills a static function. It gives the cell stability, but cells can also rearrange this network in very complex ways to do active processes such as cell locomotion.
Are these individual filaments,
Pretty much, I guess. I mean, this is freeze edge. So you get some, of course, some dried out stuff around the filament, so they look probably a bit thicker than they are, but of course often they're also bundled, and here probably you see that there are three going into one and so on. So bundling is one of the very important control parameters that cells have to control the networks. If you study these things, you have the advantage in semi-flexible or in biopolymers that you can actually start from scratch. You can sort of look at the single filament and then go up in scale and then look at networks and try to understand the physical properties of such systems sort of from the basic building blocks. And I have actually two videos here for two cases of biopolymers that differ in stiffness. These are actin filaments, and this is a microtubule. Fred already mentioned that yesterday. These are all semi-flexible, and the reason for them, the pretty simple scaling argument to see why biopolymers are usually semi-flexible, has just to do with the way the bending rigidity scales with the diameter of the filament or the monomer size. Basically, semi-flexible means that the persistence length is much larger than the diameter of the filament or the monomer size. the persistence length is related to the Young's modulus, but multiplied with this cross-sectional moment that scales like the fourth power of the diameter or the monomer size. And therefore, the aspect ratio, the persistence length divided by the monomer size, scales pretty steeply with monomer size. So if you put in some typical numbers like a gigapascal for the Young's modulus, you get persistence length for monomer sizes on the order of tens of angstroms between 10 microns and millimeters. And these are kind of two, well, it's not an extreme example. In this case, actin is relatively stiff, but microtubules are very stiff. They're millimeters, have a persistence length of millimeters. So if you look at the motion, thermal motion you see in the microscope, if it runs, then, come on. Going on here. This is actually a filament caught at one end in an optical trap. No, that's not working now. See if this one is working. This one is working. This is also using optical tweezers. So there's two optical tweezers, two beads attached to this microtubule, and one bead is stationary, the other one is moved by moving external lenses. And they can actually bend this microtubule, which has a diameter of about 25 nanometers.
What's on the other end
here? What's? Well, that's, of course, dirt around. So this little blob, you mean?
Well, the continuation of the filament, right?
I mean, of course, yeah. I mean, the end of the filament, but there was some little blob, I guess. I think in those days, we used actually carnosine to bind the beads to the microtubules, which we don't anymore. So this may actually... It may be something that has some carnosine on it. That's not really. This is a motor protein. That's a different talk. So I'm not going to go into detail with that.
Is that tomorrow?
No. Isn't that you guys tomorrow?
No.
I know why this doesn't work here. Maybe just because it's kind of neat to see the difference in the elasticity in the thermal motions. Okay, that goes away. No way. Okay, so you see this bead is trapped here, and this thing go away here. This bead is in the trap, this bead is on the ground, and here's this fairly freely fluctuating actin filament. And you can move the trap around and put tension on the filament, measure the fluctuations of the filament, and so on. So,
the optical trap is strong enough to bend the microtubule?
Oh, yeah, it doesn't take much force at all. I mean, the bending you can do with a fraction of a piconewton at this length. You know, this is 10 microns or so in length. And so the buckling is doesn't cost much force. And then, of course, it stays pretty soft when you bend it.
When you get down to like a couple microns, you can't buckle it.
Well, this is fairly low laser power. So in principle, you can crank up the laser power. There are all sorts of problems with shining too much laser light on biological specimens. So if you put a watt or 2 watts in there, you may actually fry your proteins. So this is usually working with milliwatts. Rheology. So of course, there's a well-established field of rheology. It's very common to characterize materials, especially polymeric materials, soft materials, with one of these devices. The common commercial device is a so-called plate and cone rheometer that is, say, on the order of centimeters, 5 centimeters, or 10 centimeters in size here. You need a fairly large amount of sample, but these things are, of course, perfected and quite sensitive to get good numbers for homogeneous materials. One disadvantage of these machines is, of course, that they're fairly large, and that means the frequency range is quite limited. So you can go to maybe 20 hertz or so in oscillatory excitation, but not much faster. And there are various other geometries that you can build yourself or sometimes buy. You can do a quad concentric cylinder kind of rheology. In Eric Zuckmann's lab years ago, we developed this kind of floating disk rheometer. Paul Janmi has worked quite extensively with these parallel plate, relatively small rheometers, and so on. But they all have in common that they're fairly large, centimeter size and scale, and relatively slow. What do you want to measure? Well, usually you want to measure the shear elastic deformation of your object. which in this kind of systems is usually a viscoelastic object. So there's some viscous part, and either it's a solid, so there's an elastic modulus at zero frequency, or there's some creep and reptation or relaxation at low frequencies, so that it becomes a fluid. The simple Hooke's law equivalent, of course, for a solid is a stress-strain relationship, and that defines the shear modulus, G. The shear modulus is usually a complex number, so there's a storage in-phase storage part and an out-of-phase loss part to the shear modulus. So I'll get back to that. Now, I should actually say in the macroscopic rheology, you have a volume constraint because you can't squeeze the gel against the fluid. So by definition, you always measure a shear elastic modulus, which will be different in the microscopic methods I'll show you in a moment. So by microrheology, different people mean different things. And I'll mainly focus on a type of microrheology that uses small beads, micron-sized beads that are embedded in the system we want to study. And we follow the motion of these beads by a laser, by a focused laser. And that's kind of related to optical tweezers because that's what we do for other purposes. And it turns out that it's a very sensitive way to measure the motion of beads. These beads are small, so that means we can study the rheological properties of samples at those length scales, microns, submicron, up to a couple of microns if you want. That allows us to study, for example, inhomogeneous media. We can go from spot to spot and collect data at different locations. That's a bit tedious, of course, with one bead, so you get much better statistics if you use methods like Margaret is going to talk about probably on Thursday, where you have many beads. But you can also study small samples, and biological cells, of course, are always on the order of microns in size, and they're very inhomogeneous, so you have both these points. Third point is that in contrast to the macroscopic rheology, you can reach fairly high frequencies. With our setup, we are working in the kilohertz range. But for example, Dave's diffusing wave spectroscopy method can go up to megahertz, measuring similar effects. You can also, and which is an interesting part in these biological semi-flexible polymer systems, you can measure on different length scales and sort of probe the different characteristic length scales of your sample. Say, I mean, simply said, of course, in a mesh work that has a fairly large mesh size, you can be below the mesh size or above the mesh size. So you see drastically different behavior, of course, when the bead is slipping through the meshes and the point where the bead gets stuck. And this may be quite relevant also for biological systems because in cells you have a fairly loose network and you have all sorts of activity going on below the scale of that network, below the mesh size, say, of that network and above the mesh size of that network. Second, you can do this. We usually do that in a passive way. So that means we just observe the thermal motions of the bead and use fluctuation dissipation to back out the linear response parameters of the gel. You can also do this in an active mode. You can use, for example, the laser beam as optical tweezers and pull on the bead. And you can also use magnetic beads, which has been done in the Zuckmann lab. You can also, of course, use multiple beads and do video processing or light scattering and diffusing wave spectroscopy manner that has been done by Dave Waits in his lab. This is again a video. I hope it works.
Can you notice, what are the limits of sort of frequency range for active experiments? How fast can one?
Well, with AODs, you can, in principle, go extremely fast. So you can,
just the inertial effects that limit.
Megahertz. Yeah. Then of course you have a response from your bead in the viscous environment that depends on the viscosity of the environment and on the trap strength of your trapping beam. So that is usually in the order of kilohertz. But I guess you could crank it up. We haven't really pushed the limits on that. I mean, I guess you could crank it up to maybe 10 kilohertz or so.
In the case of optical traps, though, you can't apply as large a force as you can with magnetic.
Yeah, but okay, that's for the nonlinear. Did I talk? Did I say anything about nonlinear? No.
Frequency by other factors. I forget exactly what the
magnetic beads.
Realistic limitation for magnetic beads.
Well, of course, I mean, if you have an electric magnet, then you have some kind of hysteresis effects in the field.
They, in practice, they can't actually go much higher than. But 100 hertz is not too far from where
you need a fairly strong field, of course. So you need some metal pole shoes. And
how fast can you go with an optical tweezer?
Well, with AODs, you can go megahertz. You know, that's not the problem.
Force, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You can't get a large enough force when you go really high frequencies because the stress, the viscous stress, must be going way up.
High enough force for what? I mean, the question is, what is your sensitivity on measuring something?
Yeah.
And if you oscillate something, it's a lock-in technique in a way. So you get very sensitive. So even if you're below the roll-off of your bead response, if you measure angstrom or less than an angstrom amplitude, which you can in principle if you have, if you integrate over a long enough time, I think you can go pretty high. Actually, we haven't really pushed the limits, so we haven't really tried at all.
Have people pursued AFM very much in the same frequency range?
AFM has, in principle, a much larger mass to move around.
Yeah.
So first of all, it's usually resonant. So even if you work underwater, you have a sort of an overdamped, not totally overdamped, but a sort of close to being overdamped resonant spring. And that is usually in the order of kilohertz or so, that resonance frequency with a stiff cantilever. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it also cuts you off. I mean, of course, AFM has lots of other problems that you have to be on a flat surface and you can't be inside anything and so on. So yeah, I guess Josef has done the experiment with a bead on the end of a Josef case.
It's not the same number as the macroscopic, though, as tens of hertz.
Tens of hertz? Is that really?
That's at least the maximum.
Okay.
I think this is easier to push to higher frequencies than AFM for all these geometrical reasons. So actually, when you were looking here, this moves a little bit, the speed. Oh, does it work? Let's see, is it doing the same thing again? Here we go, yeah. This is thermal motion. So it's just jiggling in an actin gel of, I think, 1 mg per mil or so density. Then this one here?
No,
this is the DIC. This is the way we use, for beats we don't really need that, but we use that to image microtubules, for example. It's differential interference contrast. It gives this funny shading effect. So now the trap was on, and here the trap is on again, and you can pull the bead away from its equilibrium position and then let go, and it comes back, elastically rebounds. So if you look at this, if you look a bit more closely, you see that it's quite non-linear, because sometimes you pull the bead in this direction, the bead actually makes sort of a loop this way, and it comes back on that same loop, and that's reproducible. So one thing I didn't mention before, that semi-flexible, but Fred already mentioned that semi-flexible polymer networks are very nonlinear. And one good reason for using passive methods is to really get the linear response parameters, where you don't run into these nonlinearities. And only a percent or a few percent of strain seems to show nonlinearities for example, actin networks.
What's that distortion you can see as we move it?
The wake?
Yeah.
I wonder if that's optics.
That's mainly optics. Yeah. This, you get a little bit of
stuff moving way off to the side, the wings.
Well, this is of course a polarization method. So,
right, so that's my point. Are you seeing some kind of stress?
If you look in this resolution, I guess you don't really see it too well. You do see in the microscope that that you get sort of a background flicker from the network itself. So there's some imaging going on with the network. And if you put strain on this thing,
see the way it's moving?
That's optical.
This is optics here. This wing here. Yeah. This is optics. Yeah.
But you wouldn't get any birefringence if you did this.
Well, this is not cross polarized. This is with the Wollaston and so on. Yeah. In cross polarized, you get huge birefringence.
Even with this kind of deformation.
Oh yeah, but I haven't done this here recently. But I did this way back in my thesis.
Yeah.
So if you put cross polarizers in there, you get huge
that was
signals.
A bigger push, wasn't it?
Well, there was, but not in distance. I mean, the beads were maybe a bit bigger, you see it right away. What's that? If you were to put cross polarizers, I mean, it's partial alignment. You need to quantify it, so I guess you can use Rudolf Oldenburg's machine to quantify the birefringence.
Very highly non-two-dimensional light. I mean, usually when this is done in rheology, people take care to make it as two-dimensional as possible and use lots of blah, blah, blah.
This is pretty three-dimensional, and
convolution thing.
And you look through the whole sample and get a long-range elastic field. One thing we sort of looked at, if you can get from the optical signal, that when you just train your laser somewhere here instead of on a bead, you do get a signal. In principle, one should be able to get some information out of that.
If you hold it long enough, will the restoring cost go away, or is it
Well, if you rip it I don't think this was part of this movie, but at the end of the stretch, I think I went all the way out here, and then you rip it, and then it doesn't come back. Holding it long enough, again, I didn't try here. I mean, also from my old experience with this type of non-length controlled actin gel, I mean, you can create these birefringent patterns, and they stay for days or weeks or so. So the relaxation, the reptation, I think, is very slow here. At least there's a large fraction of filaments that are pretty much stuck to some other filaments. But we haven't done that quantitatively. Okay, tweezers, we use sometimes for holding things, but mainly actually just as a detection beam. So maybe you know how it works anyway. But the trick is you focus a laser into a microscope. We use a near-infrared laser, 1064 nanometers. With a high NA lens, you get a pretty tight focus of about half a micron or so, which we can open up a little bit to measure these fluctuations without exerting too much force. So that's sort of a trade-off, depending on what you want to do. But we do use it actually in the other examples I'll show you later to hold the beads in a viscous medium. In a elastic medium, of course, the beads are stuck where they are, and we don't want to move them. But in the FD virus solution, which has fairly short length filaments, we want to actually hold the beads in a certain position. For two-bead rheology, we want to hold them at a given distance, and therefore we need the trap. I don't think I need to get into the principle. One trick we use for detection, I'll show you actually in the next slide, the light interacts with the bead, and that creates the force, but that, of course, creates a force, and the force pair that also changes the propagation direction of the light. So you can actually use the detection of the deflection of the light beam to measure the displacement and the force on the bead. And this is sort of roughly how it looks like. You can actually interpret this or model this as an interference effect, where the scattered light from the bead interferes in the far field with the light going through the focus. This is a bit different from the usual scattering scenario, because you have a high NA beam illuminating the bead, high NA going out, so you have a spherical wave in the far field interacting with this spherical wave. And why this works is basically a trick that's, it's in Born and Wolf. It's the so-called GUI phase shift, that there's a, and when you go through a focus, there's a phase shift, and this phase shift makes this into a first-order interference effect that actually shifts the maximum intensity in the back focal plane here laterally when the bead is moved laterally in the focus. Okay, and that is quite sensitive, and since you have a lot of light here, you have milliwatts or so of laser light focused on this half micron bead or 1 micron bead, you actually don't, you're not strongly limited by photon counting or by shot noise, and therefore you get very high sensitivity in position detection. It's on the order of nanometers or better. Actually, you can directly measure the force if you know the intensity, because what I said before, this is just a momentum transfer force pair. And then if you look at that distribution of light in the back focal plane of the condenser and you move the bead, this is a fixed bead moved with a stage back and forth, you see how the light is shifting back and forth. This the back focal plane in our condenser is about 20 millimeters in width, and we image that usually on a photodiode, not on a CCD, but here just to demonstrate the effect, we image it on a CCD. Okay, now we have this fluctuating bead in the network, and we want to learn something about the network. So we need to interpret the time series data that we get, and basically we want to extract G prime and G double prime as a function of frequency from the fluctuations in time. What we first do is we calculate a power spectral density. Then we use fluctuation dissipation, which relates the power spectrum of this position fluctuation of the bead to the imaginary part of the compliance. The compliance defined here as the it's a function that relates the force exerted on the bead to the displacement that the bead experiences. Now, of course, I don't need to explain that here. We are using thermal fluctuation, so we don't use an oscillating force, but of course you can just write this in the Fourier in Fourier space. So fluctuation dissipation then gives us from this power spectrum the imaginary part of alpha, but alpha is inversely related to G, because that's sort of a generalized Stokes-Einstein relationship that in this form at least holds for an incompressible medium. And I guess I don't need to explain that. Probably any need for further details on that. This is 1/6 pi eta diameter, basically, but in a frequency-dependent way. So you replace the viscosity by a complex shear modulus. And that works under certain conditions, and it needs a few approximations. But for our frequency range and bead size and sort of parameters of the gel, it works pretty well. So you just have the imaginary part, but of course you know that the imaginary part is related to the real part, which you need to invert this, basically, you know, get G prime out of this 1/(α) expression. You know it's related by a Kramers-Kronig integral. That can be problematic if you don't have data over a large enough time range, but it turns out we can get data over a couple of orders of magnitude in time and frequency. So we can actually use this integral, but we have to take some sort of cutoff from the ends into account. So the end of the cutoff effects on this integral affect the result for alpha prime about a decade or so into the data. And then we're basically done. We just need to invert the this alpha, the complex alpha, and get the G prime and the G double prime. There are some parameters you have to keep an eye on. First of all, trivially, you want the bead size to be larger than the mesh size because you don't want the bead to slip through the meshes unless you stick it to the meshes. In our case, we make sure that we don't stick the beads to the filaments. You want, or you usually have a case where an entanglement length, which is sort of telling you over which length scale the filaments are fixed, is larger than the mesh size, but that is a parameter you can in principle vary by cross-linking, for example, and that should have a large effect on the data. It's also the case for our experiments with actin that the persistence length is quite a bit larger than the mesh size. Actin filaments have a persistence length of about 15 microns, and the mesh size is typically on the order of micron or between half a micron and a micron. And the frequency range we usually cover with our setup is between, say, a tenth of a hertz and about 20 kilohertz.
Can I ask a question? Mm-hmm. The low bound of the frequency, at least if you're using this formula, should be bound by the strength of your potential because it destroys the free diffusion problem.
So
as you make the potential stronger, you should go to higher frequencies to see free diffusion.
You don't see free diffusion, but of course you can correct. In principle, you can correct for the trapping. You can.
That's quite complicated, in fact.
Maybe we should talk about that. We did it so far. Well, two steps in this procedure. The first, with the actin experiments, we don't need to trap at all. We turn the laser down to half a milliwatt and open it up, so the trapping is totally negligible. So a bead in solution wouldn't stay in the trap at all. So KT is larger than the potential depth. For the FD data, we actually have to use a little more, like a few milliwatts. The virus I'm going to talk about in a moment. I'll show you pictures of this. But that's a different kind of sample where there's less entanglement, so it's more viscous. So we do have to grab the beads and hold onto them. It looked like it was working pretty well, just subtracting the G prime from the trap that we measure separately from the G prime measured in the gel. But I'm also not quite sure. This is sort of pretty fresh data. So I think there may be some sort of mixing going on that is not so easy to correct for. But if you have thought about that, we should maybe talk about that later. I'll show you later how it sort of works with our data. So this is actin data that Bernhard took a couple of years ago. And this is also, let's see, who asked the question yesterday about, no, he's not here. How well you can differentiate slopes. So this is kind of showing, making this point. The black line is water or buffer. It's glycerol. In this case, glycerol because it's more viscous, so we can get a longer time range without having seeing the trap potential here. But anyway, this is a slope of -2 in the power spectral density, what you expect for free diffusion of this bead in a purely viscous environment. And then these three curves are an actin solution, 1 mg/mL in this case, but with different bead sizes. So you see there's a difference in slope, and the difference, if you actually calculate, is 1.75 here in the slope, actually it's in this middle part, and the difference between -2 and -1.75 is pretty clearly visible. You see all sorts of cutoff effects down here. Well, the most prominent of those is, of course, the anti-alias filter in the back. But we also have been having some problems with attenuation here that I think we have solved, but that's sort of a technical issue.
Why do you have attenuation problems with React and not with the
Because this is, let me see, this was this is a small beat here, I guess. It depends on the absolute intensity, and if you work, the glycerol didn't move very much. So if you work at fairly low, if you're pushing the limits, then in spite of your anti-aliased filter, you get a little bit of aliased power into this tail, and then sometimes it just sort of conspires to lift up this end. So it's basically a noise effect that we never take this part too serious. But here we have a real problem of attenuation, which I think we have solved. I think it has to do with the charge carrier diffusion time in these diodes for infrared, because in infrared you penetrate deeper into the semiconductor, and then your electron hole pairs need a bit of time to diffuse back. I just had actually a student called UDT, and they said it could give you kilohertz attenuation for the ones we were using. So that was a big problem for a while, and I hope it's solved now. It was kind of dumb to not think about that. Anyway, so what do you expect for G prime, G double prime in viscoelastic solids? Well, first of all, it could be a solid or a viscous fluid. You expect some kind of viscous behavior at very low frequencies if the sample is not cross-linked. So a slope of 1 for the G double prime and a slope of 2 for the G prime. You usually get something called a rubber plateau where the G prime is independent of frequency and some intermediate frequency range. And when you begin to approach the 1 over the relaxation time of a single mesh, then you get into a scaling regime where both G prime and G double prime scale. Now, the details of this are actually quite interesting. And in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of work. Dave Morris and others, and also Tony Max, and have really looked at the scaling behavior and the various transitions you may or may not actually be able to see in real data that occur here. This is real data, so you see it's, of course, much more noisy and also limited in the frequency range. Different smaller beats give a sort of an insufficient sampling or an insufficient picture of the bulk modulus because they are too close to the mesh size. So if you focus on the biggest bead here, which is 5 microns, which is about 10 times larger than the mesh size, we think we're pretty much in the bulk limit. And here it turns out you don't really see the plateau. It may just start down here for this actin sample. But you see something that, looks at least like a scaling regime. And it may be, as Dave Morris has pointed out, it may be actually still a complicated transition regime, and the true scaling regime may be above that. But what's important is that it's quite different from what you get in flexible polymers. So this slope here, power law slope, is omega to the 3/4, and that is related to this famous T to the 3/4 scaling in diffusion also, subdiffusion, some people call it, for semi-flexible polymers. So actually this is all...
So the G double prime is actually larger?
Yeah, the G double prime, of course, takes over at high frequencies.
It
depends on the scaling. They're related by chromostronic. So if the scaling is omega to 1/2, they're on top of each other. That's right. That has to be the case. The difference in the amplitudes here is related to the scaling power.
The
D double prime is what you get directly from the data.
Yeah.
And it's always changes less than the G prime, but subtle changes, of course, in the G. You remember the change was from -2 slope in the power spectrum to -1.75, which is not a big change, but this change produces the G prime. If the slope is -2, there's no G prime. Okay, so only a subtle change in this, basically in this G double prime, gives you the G prime.
In a sense, G prime is always noisier.
Yeah. The way you get it, it's noisier, and it's only a small effect on the G prime where you get it from.
I forgot to ask my classical question.
Oh.
Can you be sure that the bead does not stick to one of the filaments?
Well, that's a good question. I get to that. Okay. We in the old days, we tried that. We just put small enough beads in a dilute enough gel and just make sure that they went through the meshes. So we use silica beads and we use polystyrene beads. Polystyrene are usually a bit more sticky to everything, to proteins, than silica beads because silica is charged, actin is negatively charged. So, but we convinced ourselves that there was no difference between the different bead types. And as I said, they didn't stick. Stickiness may, of course, also interfere with the polymerization, because the way we make these gels is we mix monomers, actin monomers, with beads and then polymerize. So if there's some enhanced polymerization near the surface of the bead, of course, we get sort of a brush sticking out of the bead, which would really distort the results. And there is actually some distortion going on, and that is a major motivation for two-bead microrheology. Just another sanity check here. If you do this on pure buffer, this whole business, and you get a G prime that that's constant and corresponds to the trap, and you get a slope 1G double prime that corresponds to the viscosity of the solvent. And this, usually I plot things in hertz, but this is in radial, in angular frequency. So just to see that at 1 hertz, you should get for water 0.01 centipoise, and that's 10 to the minus 3 Pascal. So this looks reasonable.
I just ask one other question about method. When you're looking at this effect of bead size, you tried several beads.
Mm-hmm.
You said that the larger ones, you were sure you're in the limit, but I don't think I saw two experimental data as you increase the bead size that were the same. And I thought that to be safe, you'd really want to have a series that you visibly saturated the effect of bead size.
This is also a motivation to go to two-bead rheology, that you get away from those effects. So, this is a couple of years ago now. So, I mean, there was, this is scaling fairly well, but cutting off here. One thing we're doing now, trying to fix now, is this cutoff here, so we can go to higher frequencies and we can get a clearer picture. And with two bead, I think we can also get away from the bead artifacts a little bit.
But the size of the bead relative to the mesh size, two beads won't get you out of that.
Well, yeah, they will, because you see what's happening in between. The scale, the relevant scale, is the distance between the two beads, not the bead size.
Still, yes, still 10 times the mesh, so it's not just the mesh. There's something else going on.
I don't believe Hadley the arguments to say it's 10, because I think that crossover could be very, very subtle.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm saying the naive limit. You're clearly not.
Right, but
there's something else going on.
And that's
you can actually see that too when you look at the expected scaling with radius that you.
I didn't show all the old data here again, but yeah, so I want to get to the new data. But
should be valid, and there's deviation from that as well.
But I mean, if the actual background viscosity is high enough, if that's a molecular weight dependent thing, not an entangled molecular weight thing, then the transportation of these beads could be dominated by rare fluctuations of the local. Gel size, and you could be miles from measuring the bulk of the scope, even factor 10.
Well, when one way out of that is with the two beads that I get to, the distance, the length scale that comes in there is the distance between the two beads. And that you can vary, of course, over a much larger range.
Yes.
So there you can play with that length. So just another thing that I wanted to point out, without getting into all the details of what transition behaviors there may be, you do expect very large effects from, for example, cross-linking, but also from bundling. And both bundling and cross-linking are very important regulation principles in cells. So actin networks, but also microtubule networks, are constantly cut to size, bundled, and cross-linked, and all that stuff by other proteins. And in contrast to flexible polymers, where the cross-linking really just extends the plateau to zero frequency, for semi-flexible polymers, you expect a huge increase in the plateau modulus because you decrease the effective entanglement length because the entanglement length was much larger than the mesh size to begin with the Semenov formula, for example. And so you do expect orders of magnitude, like 3 orders of magnitude, 4 orders of magnitude changes here. And this may actually also be, or it's believed nowadays to be the reason for pretty inconsistent results with macroscopic rheology on these type of bio networks in the past. The other effect you would expect, if there's bundling going on, Because up here, well, sorry, one step back. If you have different amounts of crosslink here, you would expect at high frequencies to have these curves all merge again to one master curve for a single filament in one mesh, which is a nice test if you have the frequency range that you really have crosslinking that's causing the effect. Of course, there could be bundling, and crosslinking and bundling may not be so easy to separate because any protein that crosslinks may, in high concentrations, also bundle. Then you would, of course, get more rigid rods between the entanglement points, and that would shift your curve out to higher frequencies for the single filament behavior. But you do expect large changes, and that's and of course Margaret is probably going to show you how large effects you get from crosslinking. Now for actin, we couldn't really get to the point where they merged, but we tested a few different actin preps, and we had one or a few from our lab and one from Paul Jamy's lab. And there were obviously there was obviously something else going on, because for example here this 2 mg per mil actin from our lab was pretty soft, whereas the 2 mg per mil from Paul's, and I think it was Josef still making that, I forgot, was pretty stiff. And so they don't seem to, you know, they also didn't seem to run together. And here these two curves overlapped, and so they look at the orders of magnitude here. So this is just to illustrate the effect of sample cross-linking stuff going on in these.
Wait, is that labeled correctly? The 0.2 milligram per milliliter is thicker than the 2 milligram per milliliter?
Yeah, yeah. So cross-linking really can throw you off in a major way.
But it looks like they're converting, right?
Well, these guys, but when they shouldn't, huh?
Yeah.
So this is done with a tweezer or without?
This is at very low trapping power, so no G prime coming in from the tweezer.
Trapping one, do you see the bead just wander around indefinitely?
This low concentration, or it's stuck?
What about the point of the 2 mg per mil actin 1?
Well, that's totally stuck. I mean, it's very stiff.
What?
The bead doesn't go anywhere. It's a solid.
It's just
jiggling around its equilibrium position, but it's.
Am I reading this wrong?
Well, frequency, yeah. But there is an elastic, there's a G prime. Yeah, so there is a G prime. It's maybe low, but it means they're jiggling with a fairly high RMS amplitude. But they're not going anywhere because they're really, there's no creep really that makes them go anywhere on the scale of hours. So I guess I should hurry up a little bit to get to the newer stuff. So we're already talking about problems with one-bead microrheology. One problem is you could have something on the surface that enhances, either makes it sticky for the filaments. It could enhance polymerization, or it could just also cause the opposite. It could cause a depletion layer. If there is no interaction, you just, for sterical reasons, you do expect a depletion layer with these semi-flexible polymers. And one way around that, that was sort of started by John Crocker and Dave Waits a while ago, is to use two beads and look at the correlated fluctuations between the two beads. And then this length scale that we were talking about, this the R from the bead actually gets rolled over in the characteristic length scale is then the difference between the distance, spatial distance between the two beads. And Alex Levine and Tom Lubensky have worked this out. You have, of course, more data. You have we usually detect two-dimensionally, so we have two directions of fluctuation on each bead. So we can look at the correlations in the direction of the connection between the two beads, and we can look at the fluctuations at right angles, so they're normal to that. And in principle, we could also look at the cross terms, but those are second order. So it turns out we can extract not just the shear elastic modulus, but we can also extract both Lamé coefficients or the compressional modulus of the gels from these correlated fluctuations. And one test, of course, we can do right away is if you look at buffer only or if you look at an incompressible network, we should get this ratio here. If you just look at how this divides out here, this should be 2 if the gel is incompressible, if the Poisson ratio is 1/2. And you also see that there's a scaling in here that is an easy test. There's a 1 over R. And where here it is. There's a 1 over R here, which where R is the distance now between the two beads. So that's the first thing to look for. Oh, actually, there's a video here. Let's see. But again, you don't see very much because these are 5 micron beads. In I believe this may have been just buffer, and we were trapping them. But just to give you an idea of the scales involved here, these are 5 micron beads, about 10 microns apart or so. And in a sample cell that's about 100 microns deep, and we usually keep them about 15 microns or so above the bottom surface.
And we should be able to measure the correlation
function. Should I give you a little more time or integration time? Or? Well, you need statistics. So here's again the sketch of the setup: two beams, two laser beams, trapping in the case of the viscous solutions, trapping the beads, and then two detectors that give you X, Y time series data to then correlate.
The sample thickness is schematic.
Yeah. As I said, there's about 100 microns depth here, and the beads are 5 microns or so, and about 15 above the ground. So we do see actually the cutoff effect from the surface if you go too far apart. Same story again. We have now two time series data. We define a mutual correlation, a mutual compliance that I defined here. I forgot to explain. So we just have a few more indices, but basically we have again an alpha relating the displacement of bead number one to the force on bead number two, and then of course the x, y, z directions. So same idea that you we first calculate power spectral density, then for the two beads, and then we get the power spectral density of the cross correlation function. Use fluctuation dissipation to get alpha double prime of the various combinations of the two beads and directions, and then use Cramer's chronic again to get g of omega and lambda of omega, or mu and lambda. So the system we have tried this out with first is FD virus, and that's a sort of a toy system because it's fairly well characterized, and it's a monodispersed polymer. It's fairly flexible. It's about a micron long, and the persistence length is about 2 microns, a bit more floppy than actin, and you can make it in fairly large quantities. And you know, Jay Tang is collaborating on this with us. He has done macroscopic rheology with the Zuckmann group, for example, and there's quite a bit of data out there on these viruses. So first, some spectra. I ignore the noise down here. This just to show you the scaling. So this is, well, it's already the imaginary part of the compliance, but it's basically directly related to the power spectral density of these cross terms for different distances between the two beads. And the point here I only want to make is that the scaling seems to work pretty well. I can collapse them on top of each other with this 1/distance, multiplying by the distance. So that's a first sanity check. Then, of course, I can go ahead and calculate the G prime for these different pairs of beads. And I see they sort of agree pretty well. It gets very noisy here, of course. And this guy is the furthest distance. And here you really see the noise coming in, because the correlation, of course, gets weaker and weaker, like 1/r. And at some point, noise takes over. And if the slope gets steeper, it looks more like diffusion. So that means G prime goes down. So sort of the other way around from what you expect. The noise in the data actually kills G prime, if you want. Now,
are you going to overlay 1-point result on that, just for comparison?
They were agreeing.
The FD system is in a range where 2-point may not give you that much of
it. Exactly, it doesn't actually. I thought I had one here. Wait.
Because it's much more flexible.
That's right. And
also, the mesh size
is smaller. These beads are large. These are 5 micron beads. I thought I had one in here. Sorry. The mesh size, we're working at about 15, well, between 5 and 18 mix per mil or so.
Less than 100 nanometers.
So it's 100 nanometers or so on that scale. And the beads here were 5 microns again. But I guess the length is more important.
So it's less than 10 times the filament diameter.
The mesh size.
Yeah.
The filament diameter is about 100 angstroms, a bit less, yeah. Okay, so now looking at G prime and G double prime for these things, so if we spend some time, this is pretty sort of preliminary, sort of hot off the press data, so we don't quite understand what's going on yet. The blue line is the G double prime, red line is G prime. We were kind of expecting some plateau behavior or so, but maybe not so much either, because these things are fairly short. So it's more like a viscous fluid than an entangled polymer solution. So the plateau may very well be washed out. We would expect at very low frequencies the G prime to be quite steep with a slope of plus 2 below the plateau, which we don't seem to see here. And this should be one which is at low frequencies, which is also doesn't seem to be the case, unless you believe, yeah, that's maybe gone there, but it's not clear. At high frequencies, it doesn't seem to be either 3/4 or 1. Discussing with Dave, I guess he convinced me that I should expect a slope of 1 there for more or less the rigid rod, friction of the rigid rod, because they're so short. But then what seems to make somewhat sense is that the G prime kind of lags behind here, because if this is more than 3/4, if it's getting more than 1, at 1/2 it should be superimposed, at 3/4 should be quite a bit away, at 1 it should really go out here, and then there's maybe this 5/4 part that comes in later, and it may join again at very high frequencies and make 3/4. But of course we're limited in frequency range. So it's a bit puzzling still. There seems to be a sort of a 1/2 regime here for the G double prime, which I guess nobody understands.
The high end doesn't look that different from some of the smaller V data for actin, though.
For actin, it was a bit shallower than 3/4. It was the other way around.
Where the G double prime goes above 3/4 and the G prime goes below.
Yeah, but it was rather shallower than steeper. It was certainly below 3/4 and not above 3/4 for the G double prime. So yeah, this crossing over may or may not be relevant. What's that? Well, this is all transition, so it can be anything really. I mean, only if you have a really real scaling regime, they're related. But they're close together here, and that's sort of half. So it's Kramers chronic, so it's a long range integral. So it really doesn't say anything about a local slope. To get some bearings here, the concentration is quite a bit over C star, the 1 over 1 filament per L cubed estimate for the entanglement limit. And so 300 times larger than that should mean that they're quite well entangled, or at least that the rotational diffusion is quite hindered.
But they're nowhere near pneumatic?
Well, they could be. Let's see, Jay was saying the pneumatic is like 20 or so.
Yeah,
so it is somewhat getting there, but I think it's still far enough away. And they have a concentration dependence in the next one here, gone from 5 to 50 nix per mil. And they sort of qualitatively seem similar. So I don't think, at 5 there shouldn't be a pneumatic phase. So I don't think
this
it's.
This is not 1 beat microamateur,
right? This is all 1 beat. I could have shown you also 2-beat curves, but they pretty much superimpose. So,
but it does look more like
1-beat. They're okay. I was planning to show you that. That was last night, last minute. I can maybe pull that up later for people who are interested. They agree pretty well. We do have a disagreement problem with the macro data, though. So this is. So this is all still a bit in jury still out and so on.
But your deviations from expected scaling regimes and so on is probably not a diffusion-like effect.
No, I don't think so. At least the qualitative slope behavior of the 2-beat is exactly the same. They're more noisy, but apart from that, they're the same. Karim, the graduate student who's working on this, is still evaluating the last batch of data. So we have a lot more, but this is still kind of the first set of data. G prime again shows a bit more slope. I checked if the correction is relevant for the trapping trap stiffness, but it's a minute effect. The trap stiffness is 0.1, it's down here, and so this is like one width of this line here difference if I just subtract it. So I don't think the trap itself is doing anything here, and there seems to be a difference in the slopes, but it may also be kind of a transition that occurs at different frequencies. So if you believe that there's something shallower and then a bit steeper, so maybe the shallower part goes out further in this one.
When do you expect that transition to have a higher frequencies for a stiffer gel?
Well, you expect, for higher concentration, you expect to have scales shifted out to the right. So But there's no real kink in this data anyway, so.
Wait a minute, the upturn of the curve, I mean, the simulation that you think it's not a trap effect?
This is not a trap effect, no, because I showed you the trap data before. This was 0.1 Pascal for the trap in the same buffer. So if I subtract that from here, it's a minute difference before plotting it. I mean, maybe there's something we're overlooking still, but I think that would be interesting to discuss. I looked at the concentration dependence at high relatively high frequencies, just to see if it scales with any reasonable power of the concentration. It seems to be about 1, which is reasonable, but it scatters quite a lot. So there's quite a bit of noise still in this experiment. I should say there is an issue with bead size. If you have different experiments and you capture different beads, only if they're only very slightly polydispersed, you get a power. Sort of a cube effect on the detector sensitivity, because that's a scattering. So you're quite sensitive to bead polydispersity.
And that comes in somehow into this 2-point curve?
That comes, well, it's maybe a little less, it's maybe a bit better with the 2-point because you have 2 beads at the average over, but that's about all. No, I mean, if...
But you should, but why, you're just looking at cross-correlation between them.
Yeah, but you need well, if one bead is larger than you think, the other one is smaller than you think, then you get get less correlation than you, and you measure less correlation than you actually have, or vice versa. This technology is still in development. So what we're trying to do now is actually calibrate every single bead with AODs just by wiggling the AOD over the bead. So far we've done it, separately, and you can't do it with the same bead, obviously.
Do you record a position sequence of the function of time and then calculate the 2-point
cross-correlation
with that, or do you offline?
Yeah. Yeah. We're just supposed to calculate the whole time series and then do fast Fourier transforms offline. We just Fourier transform the two and then multiply, and then you get the cross-correlation, the power spectral density.
Okay.
Now, this other effect that I mentioned before, the ratio between this alpha parallel, which is along the line of connection between the two beads, and the alpha perpendicular, it should be 2 in the incompressible limit, and that looks pretty reasonable. This is the imaginary part, and this is the real part. For FD, since the mesh size is so small, you don't really expect to see a deviation from that where you begin to see compressibility. So I was happy to see the 2 here in the real part. The imaginary part should be 0, just for double checking, we plotted it here. We did some more experiments with actin now, but the graduate student working on that is still busy trying to pull the data out, so I don't even know yet if it's 2 or not. I think Margaret has some evidence that it also seems to be 2 and not go into less than 2 at low frequencies, which I would have expected. So I'm really curious to see if we can see that.
It'll be dependent on the separation.
It'll be dependent on the separation. So we were looking at beads fairly close together at a mesh at a fairly dilute actin. So where we should see it most.
No, at short distances.
Well, I hate to say this, but do you have a graph of the macroscopic rheology?
I have it in the back, yeah. Because there is obviously a problem we haven't figured out yet with the comparison between ours and the macro data, which is here. And it almost looks like the factor of 10 missing somewhere. We have pretty carefully looked at our procedure. So this is our data for, and this is not 3 millimolar. Actually, yesterday I was still thinking we had low salt, but this morning I found out we had 50 millimolar salt. So Zachmann macro and various magnetic rheologies were using the same FD virus with 100 millimolar sodium chloride.
So
it doesn't connect. No, we see a stiffer gel.
That's what I mean.
Macro is weaker than this is 50. This should be 50. Yeah? So it's comparable.
I think that just says the discrepancy is not microreality. The discrepancy is the samples.
Yeah.
Macroreality.
Really have to be.
It's FD. Yeah.
And I'm saying that's consistent with the fact.
This is with the floating top thing?
They did a bunch of different things. They had a commercial plate and cone. I mean, all the points I put in here are the same, but actually in the original paper, which is this one here, PRE, they differentiate the different methods. So up here, I think, was magnetic bead, and down here, I think, was mainly macro.
Okay, so their magnetic bead and their macro rheology read?
And video also. Video was magnetic, I think, only, yeah? Not.
No, the point is that their micro rheology using a magnetic bead and their macroscopic measurement agreed.
Pretty well. So I mean, within this width,
of an order of magnitude.
Not an order of magnitude. Yeah.
With the micro, with the 1 point and 2 point agreement as well. When the discrepancy, the point is, this discrepancy is not the same discrepancy that you're expecting, which would be inverted, which is microbiology.
Yeah. I mean, I should be a bit careful. I don't want to put this too strongly. I mean, we're still kind of busy fighting all sorts of little bugs. So. I mean, I've looked pretty hard, and I haven't seen a factor of 10 anywhere, and I can't imagine where it would be, but you never know, you know, with experimental data. So before we publish this, I think we look a lot harder.
Christoph, can I comment on the macro data?
Yeah.
It's just an example. The low-frequency behavior of the macro data actually makes a lot of sense. It fits reasonably well to the viscous part of it, anyway, fits reasonably well to a rigid rod model with a reasonable rotational sensitivity and a rod speed and volume.
About one.
That terminal behavior looks very sensible.
Numbers,
The numbers work.
Mean the actual magnitude, not just the.
No, talking about the magnitude. Yeah, so you count the number of chains per unit volume.
And so you're saying that his rheology is not sensible even from the magnitude.
The simplest to understand, because it doesn't involve the entanglement, is the terminal behavior. Because for this system, it seems to just be dominated by rod rotations.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you can make an estimate of. A modulus by just counting chains. It's just KT per chain.
Why is it rod rotation? These are entangled, so why do
the rod rotate it takes longer for the rod to rotate than to rotate. And so there is a regime which this is in where the rod rotations can actually dominate the terminal behavior.
How can it rotate at all?
Like this.
It's coupled rotation.
It reptates, but it has to reptate many times to rotate.
So it can relax.
It's not really reptation where you lose all angular orientation.
Right, but these rods are so short that becomes the slowest decaying part of the stress.
But why does that matter? It sounds like it's reptated several times before it's rotated, so why should that have any reason for stress?
Because the terminal behavior is dominated to the slowest relaxing part of stress.
No, but why should the stress should be on relaxed once it's relaxed?
No, not. I mean, if it's still in the same direction, then it's still sheared. I mean, it still has a stress on it.
Everything for rigid rods, which just depends on the overall orientation of the rod. It's about KT per rod of rotational entropy, basically entropy associated with the distribution of rod orientations.
So what you're saying is you have to rotate not just the length of the filament, but the persistence length.
It becomes flexible,
So to see such effect, the bead doesn't have to be much larger than the length of the filament.
That was macroscopic rheology.
No, I mean about the micro. I mean to see an effect like that, like the one you were talking about, in micro rheology, doesn't it mean that the bead has to be much larger than the size of the filament?
I mean, this also we have small beads that are less than.
Sorry, how do I get a modulus from that? It's KT per rod length cube.
It's KT per rod. It's KT times the number of rods per unit volume. And the prefactor is well known. It's 0.6. Sorry.
So it's getting a bit late. I just want to give you.
That makes all the difference. You nailed.
Just want to give you sort of as a teaser a different system, but I don't want to go in, since it's late getting into details. But this was something done in collaboration with the Utrecht group, and they're making these really rigid rods, bohemite rods. So it's it's described in the next slide. It's an aluminum hydroxide core and a silica shell, so it's charged, hydrophilic, but actually we look at it in DMF in an organic solvent. And what happens is these should be really rotating rods. Yeah, well, do you still have time, or if you want to see, I mean, we put beads in the rods. If they're just insolvent, they do this. You do see this depletion attraction effect, so you can actually pull them apart and they snap back together and so on. So that is mediated by the entropic effects of the rods that you don't see here, of course.
But
these beads were a micron, I think. Okay. And the rods are 200 nanometers long and 20 nanometers, so aspect ratio about 10.
And the ones are
the rods are, at this concentration, they're still pretty isotropic. And we go between between a percent or so and 6% maximally, 6% volume fraction. And what was a bit surprising is that we did get quite a big effect on the power spectra. These are just the direct power spectra of the fluctuation data of a single bead now again. And we did see a change in slopes here, which was quite measurable. And we still don't quite know how to understand that, because it's more or less a viscous medium. It has, of course, the rotational limitation that the rods can't freely rotate anymore. But we don't quite understand why we get different slopes and what kind of slopes we get. So just to give you sort of in a few words what the main results were, if you look at the high frequency limit of the curves, we get a decrease in this slope sort of towards the 1.75, which, you know, is the actin, but of course that has probably nothing to do with this here. And that depends on the salt. So it seems to be involving electrostatics.
Why lithium?
Lithium chloride. I don't know why they do that. That's I don't know if it has to do with the size of the ion.
It's stronger.
That's just a standard recipe. So we never discussed why lithium, nothing else. But basically, you get a pretty strong effect if you don't have screening. So at zero added salt, you have only the counter ions that come with a sample. Your slope goes down, but it doesn't seem to saturate either, even at this relatively high concentration of rods.
So 10 squared by rod, what does that mean?
Volume fraction in percent. Why? It should be 10 to the minus 2, I guess. Or maybe the minus is hidden here.
So that's 4%?
4% volume fraction of rods.
The true volume fraction?
As opposed to?
Well, let's see.
You mean weight per volume versus volume per volume?
Let's see, if you have rods, you could take these things and you could allow them to rotate. So
you could take
the length cube and calculate a volume fraction like that. And that should give you some idea of where things start to interact.
The C star. No, this is the real, the pure volume fraction and the C star.
So the rods, you expect this. And so don't you expect to start seeing all kinds of interactions, hydrodynamic interactions, the whole schmear.
Sure, yeah. You do expect interactions.
So
and
is that not all you're measuring with these?
Probably, but we still don't quite know. First of all, we do see electrostatic effects. So it must have something to do with charge. And of course, the charge naively would say it just increases the effective diameter of the rods, but it seems to change the slope in a major way in the power spectrum.
There's something else going on here too, which is hidden. This is time dependence. You're plotting the slope at a certain time.
At high frequencies, so, yeah. But
relatively high frequencies.
See, I mean, it's actually quite straight. So these power law slopes go over a fairly large frequency range. And
well, if you really find the volume function by increasing the diameter by the screening rate, will this details for each other?
Let's see. I know what you mean.
Because as you
want
to start, the volume function goes down.
With less salt.
And salt.
Yeah, right. This way.
And that's the point.
This is 1 point.
This is 1 point, yeah. And this I also got the data last night, so I'm not sure if she tried that, but she didn't put that in this graph. 10, 200 nanometers long and 10 nanometers wide.
What was the diameter of So I think I have to multiply.
The about 20 nanometers. So what was it here?
Yeah,
eighteen nanometers.
So it's a huge volume. It seems totally reasonable.
It's overlapping, yeah. But what?
Exactly why is this? I haven't thought about, but you would expect if I take hard spheres and I start making them really concentrated, I'm going to see.
Yeah, we did that too. We see the same kind of changes if we use spheres.
Yeah.
I don't have the data actually with me here, but
I mean, it's very interesting.
It's also electrostatic. Yeah. Just throwing this out, this is really new, and I have really not much of an idea of what it means.
But
you see, it's really, I mean, nice power law, whatever. Yeah, but many orders of magnitude, pretty straight lines. So I found that quite puzzling. Well, this one is water, I mean, the solvent, so it's plus one for the G double prime, and this is about 1.8 or so. Huh? Sorry, 1.8 minus, so it's the bead size was 1 micron.
And the rods are 0.8,
yeah. The rods are 200 nanometers long.
So they're huge
beads. Yeah, that's what we sort of want.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the G prime, it's of course pretty small, and we corrected this one for the trap, and this is maybe something we need to discuss. Maybe we didn't do it right. We did it naively by just subtracting the G prime we get from the trap, and we do some. Not quite sure why. I mean, this doesn't look noisy enough, so I'm kind of have to talk to her why this is such a straight line here. I mean, I would have expected more noise here, but there seems to be something going on here that is related to the density, of course, and that's what you expect because the slope is turning, the slope is changing in the G double prime, so that gives you the G prime here. So,
do you have any idea where you expect a rod rotation time to be for this system? I'm just looking for some sense of where you expect.
I haven't dug much into the interpretation. This is really hot off the press. But that is, of course. Actually, I want to discuss that with you also. See.
Have you done this with a rheometer?
Well, we have been looking for a rheometer to do small volumes because they can't make that large amounts. So we haven't really found. They have done the zero frequency viscosity measurements, and that's how this whole thing started. I said, well, we can maybe do it better with the frequency resolution. But they're just Ostwald viscometry kind of stuff. And we have been looking actually for a rheometer where we can use a milliliter or so to do this.
A milliliter?
Maybe or less.
Okay. Yeah, we can do
okay.
200 microliters.
Well, Chaisi is coming in summer, so
okay,
tell her to bring some stuff.
Well,
definitely.
We can do
300.
300 microliters? Okay. What? She's going to come in summer and visit all your labs, so she's going to bring lots of samples. Just again, the G prime, G double prime in one plot. So they look quite parallel here for the highest percentage rods. This is cutoff effects here at the end, so this is nothing real.
So,
it's 0.8 or so on both. It can't really be one because then this would be pretty much flat. So I guess I should close now here. So I told you, I gave you the propaganda talk, why it's nice to do microrheology. So yeah, I've heard all this. The electrostatics, like what I showed in the last part, is not understood, but that's maybe just one example of the many subtleties that you may be able to pull out one of these days from such experiments. But the other side of that same coin is, of course, that you have to be quite careful with the interpretation of your data, because you have all these funny effects of bead cost depletion, attraction, maybe, of course, hydrodynamics are long range, so surface effects and all sorts of stuff. Two bead at least seems to avoid the depletion layer effect. And unfortunately, I didn't get to show you the actin data yet, where I hope to see some added value of two bead, hoping to measure the compressibility at low frequencies. But there are many other open questions. The subtleties of the transition regimes, the various slopes and intermediate behaviors that you may want, that you may see or should see. And then the large effects that you expect from cross-linking, nonlinearities in the system, and so on that are just beginning, I guess, to be explored. And in the very beginning, I mentioned the single filament dynamics. We're also still working on doing this more quantitatively and connecting the single filament dynamics to the network behavior, because I think this is sort of a unique chance that you can do, you can span the whole range in these kind of samples. So let me finish here. Thank you.
So let me understand something. Do you think that you can see really pure single filament dynamics from microrheology without attaching a bead to a filament?
Well, the way we usually do is we do attach a bead. Can you switch it off a second? And that, of course, causes a few problems. So the actin experiment, for example, I showed in this video. So that's basically one bead here, and then the filament is bound sideways to that. That's the first problem. So what you really get is bending motions. You have a torque here at this point, and then you get sort of bending motions this way and that way that dominate. Or actually, when you put some tension on the bead, you get something like this. So it turns out that this seems to be a very fairly good way to measure the bending elasticity. Well, the bead is off center, so the optical tweezers, if you were to pull on it, would act at this point, and that bends the filament. And likewise, the fluctuations that you see when you look at the motion of the bead involve bending of the filament.
The filament is not attached to the center of the bead. Is that the point?
That's right, and so you can,
but. Well, with respect to
the right. It's substantial to compare to the diameter of the filament. Now you can use gel solid, for example, and people have done that to bind at least one of the beads kind of end on to a filament. One of these days we'll try that, I guess, but I've heard it was, well, for the motor, then you won't get much torque here, but on the other end you still have that bead because you just only binds to one end of the of the actin filament. The other problem is, of course, the bead response itself. If you want to have some force, if you want to be able to exert some force on the bead, or you know, same effect, or the size is also important, of course, for the detection sensitivity. You need a bead that scatters enough and is large enough. So you can maybe go down to 0.2 microns or so, but it's still much larger than the filament diameter. We have been, yeah, as we discussed before, we have been starting to play with quantum dots and sort of smaller things that may be bright enough to get enough photons, but be also be at the same time very small to not get a viscous cutoff that limits the frequency range.
Why is the limitation here different than with, if you're not attached to the filament?
You mean in the gel?
In the gel.
In the gel, you also get a dynamic cutoff, yeah, due to the size of the bead in a sense. But of course, the whole gel is moving pretty slow anyway. So here, you really want to probe the high frequency part of. Well, in the gel, you have this whole range in the beginning, and then here, of course, you see single bead. Yeah. So here, in principle, you have the same problem. That's why.
Okay.
So same argument here. You want to go to small beads, and then, for example, you may want to stick a bead to your network. But then again, I mean, here, if you have proven once that this is single filament behavior, you don't really care that much. You just might as well do this experiment. Mm-hmm. And you know, the interesting part may be sort of happening here.
So I guess I still would like to understand, do you believe that you see single filament behavior at high frequencies in the gel where the beads are not attached to the filaments?
Comparing this and this experiment. But we haven't really gotten to the point where we can carefully compare the two. That's the expectation, but of course, if there's any bundling going on in, say, actin networks, that would throw that off.
No, that would just mean that there are different single filament behavior. I want to know, do you believe you actually, that does microrheology probe single filament behavior? And are you satisfied that there's that we understand all the coupling between the filaments and the bead at high frequencies in this random network, that you can say that it's single filament behavior? I guess
I
understand. There are probably not people in this room who truly understand.
No, I think the answer is okay.
It would be nice to.
That's a good answer.
I mean, this is the whole reason for testing that. Huh? But this is, of course, a good chance to test that.
I'll discuss it later.
Now, I see many possible problems. I mean, there's polydispersity in the bead size, there's bundling, there's all interactions and stuff, so at very high frequencies, of course, it may happen, but how high?